Mr. Ward, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. Thank you for hearing me. I'm gonna address this in four different segments, if I can. The first one will be the exhibits that were offered by the department in our case, and the second segment will be the testimony of the expert witness, who was a psychologist. The third will be the testimony of the social worker, and then the fourth will be the motion to strike and the rulings of the court.
I'd like to ask one question, though, that I think is germane to all of these. As best I can tell, and I've gone through a number of times over the course of many years, the process of termination of parental rights. And it is a multi-step endeavor that's set out in the Code of Virginia. And to the best of my understanding, the only order other than the final termination of parental rights that's considered to be a final appealable order is an order under 16.1278.2. I call it the 60-day preliminary removal hearing statute. What order do you suggest is the appealable order in this case?
The appealable order in this case is that order.
It's the order. Where do I find that order? Because the captions seem to be there's like three or four orders in here, and I just want to make sure I'm looking at the correct order.
I'm actually looking at the appendix from the mother's case here, but I'll tell you it was. It's called an adjudicatory order for abuse and neglect, and then a permanency planning order, and a dispositional order for underlying foster
care.
I've got
the adjudicatory order for abuse and neglect cases, and that, I think, is at page 22 and 20. I'm sorry, that's the J&D order. I'm sorry. I hate to eat into your time on this,
but it's
really important, I think, that we know what order we're talking about. The adjudicatory order for abuse and neglect case is at page 641.
Yeah, that's it. That's the one I have.
Is that the order? And then they have a permanency planning order at 651.
Yeah, that would be correct. And then right after that is a dispositional order for underlying petition foster care plan.
Okay, go ahead. I'll find that.
You see them? So it was those three orders. So what happened was, in this case, the department removed a child from its parents right after they returned home from the hospital after the child's birth, about a week after the child's birth. And there was a removal hearing, what we call a five-day hearing at district court, followed by then an adjudicatory or a trial in district court, followed by a dispositional order in district court, which we appealed for trial de novo to circuit court.
Go ahead.
Okay. And it was, so we appealed the district court's finding of at risk for abuse or neglect and a permanency planning or foster care plan of adoption rather than return home from the district court to the circuit court. And then about a year later, we had trial in the circuit court. And I'll tell you, in this particular case, it was interesting because the county actually was going to put on its TPR petition while we were still on appeal from district to circuit court. And when we went in that day, the district court judge looked at us and said, I don't think I have the authority to go forward. And when we reread the statute, we realized he was right. So we have not gone to the TPR status yet. The TPR, which is something the county is pursuing, would not occur until after this appeal has been ruled on finally.
But you don't contest that this is an appealable order over which we...
It is an appealable order, and that's why we appealed it. It was the circuit court's final order that it found the child to be at risk for abuse and neglect, just like the district court had, and that it entered a permanency planning goal of adoption and a foster care goal of adoption. It was those three things that we appealed from the circuit court.
I keep looking at the 278.2 statute, and that, to me, is, unless it's part of 278.2, it's not appealable. Like a foster care plan is under 281. So I don't think, I'm not sure that the approval of a foster care plan is appealable.
Well, I think it is.
And it can change.
Not only that, well, we've actually had another foster care hearing on the matter, which we have appealed, except that this court sent our appeal back to the trial court because the trial court had neglected to enter an appointment of a guardian ad litem for the child, who is this lady right here, my friend Ms. Norloff. And so we're in the process of getting the paperwork signed to get that down to the trial court to send back to this court on appeal of the second permanency planning hearing that was the review hearing from several months ago. So this hearing that we've appealed was from last year. The second permanency planning hearing that we're also appealing was from this year. And you're right, it can change, but it hasn't. And so that's why we appealed that hearing as well. I thought I would do it in time to consolidate it, but that didn't happen.
Okay,
so our grievance here is that the court found the child to be at risk of abuse and neglect. And it did so because it found that there were a number of negatives attending the parents, and that it thought that because the parents had not seen the child for 18 months or 15 months or something like that, due to the fact that the county or the Department of Social Services cut off the visitations of the parents with the child, that it was inappropriate to send the child back home, whether or not there was any risk of abuse or neglect, and that the child was more appropriately scheduled for adoption because he was apparently doing well in foster care.
But also under 16.1.281, in terms of what the court has to find, if the parent has had other children which have in fact been removed in terms of their parental rights being terminated, there's a different factor factoring that the court takes into consideration, correct?
So the court could have found, just based on the existence of abuse and neglect findings regarding those parents with regard to other children, just based on that alone, that this child was...
The court just simply has to find that they're at risk, correct?
That's right. They're at risk. And so that was why we appealed the admission of the two court orders, one from Maryland and one from New Jersey, because it was based on those two orders that the county was trying to get the court to make its ruling. The court actually didn't seem to make its ruling based on that at all. It just said that there were a number of negatives, but it didn't actually point to the two orders. And I had, of course, objected to the orders because I said the one appears to be signed by someone who says she's a clerk of court, but we don't really have any way they didn't provide a foundation to demonstrate that she was the clerk of court. And in the other case, it was signed by someone who was just a division manager who didn't have the authority, there was no evidence that she had the authority to sign on behalf of the clerk of court. And of course, I provided a case on point for that. If somebody's going to assign on behalf of a clerk, there has to be some indicia of authority for them to do it. And so I did not want those two court orders considered by the court because that would just be an automatic basis for it to find at risk. Okay, but even if the court had some other reason for finding at risk, our problem is with the fact that the court agreed that that adoption should be the permanency goal in this case and the foster care goal. And we felt that adoption was an inappropriate goal because these children were removed based on facts that just did not meet the criteria for removal. And I'll tell you what they are. The criteria for removal are in 16.1.252. There has to be an imminent threat to life or health to the extent that severe or irremediable injury would likely result if the child were to return to the parents. And the fact is that that's never been the case. It wasn't the case on the day that the child was removed, and it's still not the case. The parents actually showed up at trial, were able to testify very clearly about what their plans were for the child. They showed pictures of their home, talked about the lease that they had on their home and the neighborhood where it was located, happens to be located out of state. But the expert witness apparently convinced the court that it was more than likely that there could be a risk of neglect if the children returned home. Now the court, I think, incorrectly said
that part of that risk was in the testimony about their inability to adequately parent. Isn't that a risk that was presented to the court?
Yes, the expert.
So isn't that something that could actually be considered in terms of whether they were in fact at risk?
I think it could be considered. I don't think that they met the preponderance standard in this case.
Why would that, included with some of the other evidence presented, not meet that preponderance standard?
Well, it might have, but the court didn't address that. All the court said was that there were several negatives involved here, and he said in collaboration with some of the things that the doctor said, the court was reluctant to go with a foster care plan of return to parents. Now, the doctor said very clearly, these parents did not abuse this child, and these parents would never abuse this child. He went up to say that abuse requires intentional behavior, and these parents wouldn't do that. What they might do is neglect the child, and he said, I think it's more likely than not that there could be a probability of risk that they could be neglected. So then the court said, well, the doctor said there was a 51% probability that the child would
so
be at
wouldn't
risk.
Wouldn't that in and alone meet the preponderance?
If that's what
just definitionally?
It would if the expert had said that. But the expert didn't say that. What he said is it's more likely than not that there's a probability of risk for neglect. And he said neglect specifically. And he pointed, I think, to the especially to the mother in this case. And my client has a traumatic brain injury that causes him to have difficulty speaking at the normal rate that people speak, but he still is able to speak and express himself. I'm sorry, I thought you were going to ask me a question, Judge. Okay, so what we had here was we had an expert coming in and saying, you know, I'm concerned about the parent's ability to parent the child. But there was just really no basis for what he was saying other than the fact that he met with them once and interviewed them and did a few tests. He didn't even do a parent-child assessment, which many psychologists do. What they do is they sit down and watch the child and the parents collaborating with one another to see if the parents are actually able to change diapers and calm the child.
But again, understanding that the court was maybe not as exact as it could be under 16.1281 in terms of relying on that more so, that's still a factor the court could consider. What it needs to put into writing, correct?
It could consider all the factors. Several of them we asked it not to consider. Let me address the one other elephant, which was the department closed its case, and then the court took a recess to come back for motions, and when it came back, the department asked to reopen its case, and the court said, sure, I'll let you do that. There's lots of authority that allows me to do that. We all know what the authority is. And we object. And the court said, I know you're going to object, I'll note your objection. And then we objected. And I think the court's authority was like the Lebanon and Hargraves cases where, you know, in criminal cases where somebody forgot to say on the stand, oh, by the way, he's the guy I saw rob the store. You know, and they had to reopen the case in order to put that down on the stand to say, who's the guy you saw rob the store? Oh, it was him. A routine matter relating to an element of the offense. And I could see in this case if somebody had forgotten to say, oh, it's those two parents right there that we're talking about, and they needed to reopen the case to do that, or even if they needed to reopen the case to say, we forgot to ask the court to admit our two out-of-state orders, can we reopen our case for that purpose and hear argument as to why it should not be or should be, I could see the court doing that. But the court actually allowed the department to reopen its case for a completely different cause of action, which was, so they had closed their case after presenting evidence on abuse and neglect, which turned out to be an at-risk finding, and then reopened the case in order to address a completely different thing, which was the foster care goal. And so my analogy in the criminal sense is that this is like having somebody, you know, break into your house. You present evidence about a break-in.
Were you aware that this was a possibility, at least? Had there not been any communications with DSS? Had there not been any communications with DSS and the parents or you about the likelihood of a foster care goal being adopted? Was it the first time you saw the planning document?
No, that was their goal from the beginning.
Okay, so what was the prejudice and the surprise that emanated from opening the case again?
I don't think we were surprised at the allegations. We felt that we were prejudiced that they were allowed to reopen the case and prove the second cause of action without which the child would have had to go home to his parents.
This was adverse to you, but in terms of trial preparation and ready to address it, that's the surprise, and I think that is an issue here, and prejudice, potentially.
Mr. Well, Warner, I'll let you answer the question. Your time is up, but please answer.
You want me to answer?
Yes, please answer. Is there anything further on that issue, surprise and prejudice?
We were not surprised at what they had to say. We were terribly prejudiced by it because of the result.
The result.
Mr. Ward, we're going to come down and greet you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This is our custom. You want to come on up? And have you had a chance to sign in, ma'am?
Yes, Your Honor.
Great. Okay. And in terms of the guardian lineup, have you all decided how we're going to do just 15-15? It's going to be easier. I know usually with these companion cases we do them differently, but given the fact there was no argument on the other side, sort of breaking up would be a little bit more challenging. How do you wish to break up your time?
The guardian lineup has indicated she doesn't wish to address the court.
That's fine.
Other than to say she joins in the department's position.
Okay. Fine. All right, Ms. Casey, I'm going to give you the 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors.
How much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
3 minutes, Your Honor, if I may.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Before I begin, if I may address a question that was prompted in Mr. Ward's presentation. The preliminary removal order, I believe, is provided in the appendix, volume 1, page 27, is the preliminary removal order. And there's also a companion portion to that order on page 36 of the appendix, same volume. If I may ask the court to take into consideration, the parents were unrepresented by counsel at the preliminary hearing and were appointed counsel on January the 4th at the conclusion of that hearing. Before the court this morning, asking the court to take into account two considerations, whether or not the removal was proper in this case, and if so, whether or not reunification would thereafter be required. The preliminary removal, I would submit to the court and ask the court to consider required a showing of either imminent threat to the child, a substantial risk of harm, and I would ask the court to consider that that required some showing that there had been an infliction of mental or physical harm to the child that presented a substantial risk of death, disfigurement, or impairment. I would ask the court to consider that in previous cases before this court, Jenkins versus Commonwealth, and instances have been presented where a newborn was removed from a mother who had been deemed mentally retarded after one day in her care, and that the court likened that issue to being analogous to dealing with a parent who suffered from substantial substance abuse issues. I would ask the court to consider that there was no showing of imminent risk in this particular case, and for presentation of that, or I'm sorry, a support of that, I would direct the court to appendix page 511, in which Honorable Judge Parker did note on line 12 there's no abuse, and I'm with you all the way. No, I'm not satisfied there's abuse, but there is a risk of abuse. I'd ask the court to take that statement.
Doesn't 16.1281 indicate that if there's a risk of abuse, that's what the court needs to find?
Yes, Your Honor. But I would ask the court to consider that after the risk of abuse is found, is the court, if I may refer to appellant's brief, after the risk is found, the juvenile or the circuit court may make any of the following findings. They may find that there is no less drastic alternative available and thereby transfer of the custody of the child should go to the department. I would say in this case that potentially because the lower court found that there was no risk of, there was no finding of abuse, rather a risk of abuse based upon the evidence presented, that there were a number of less drastic alternatives that could have been put into place, a protective order of some sort over the child, preventative services to assist the parents in reestablishing or assisting with their parental capacities. I'd ask the court to take into account consideration of the timeline in this case. On December the 22nd, which was a Tuesday, the child was born. On Wednesday, December the 23rd, the department was notified that the parents had had prior involvement with other departments of social services. On Friday, December 25th, the department had a worker who visited the hotel room where the parents were staying and left and did not take the child. It's not until Monday, December 28th, that the department notes that the worker was in contact with the other jurisdictions and obtained sufficient information to present file a petition for the preliminary removal order. I would ask the court to consider whether or not the worker believed that the child was suffering imminent or faced an imminent threat, substantial risk of harm, as again, the worker went on Friday, left the hotel room where the family was residing and did not return until the following Monday, the 28th, despite having been made aware of the previous removals or previous involvement with the previous Department of Social Services on the previous Wednesday, the 23rd.
Ms. Casey, could I ask you a question? You've got two assignments of error in your brief that were not withdrawn, that you're presenting.
Yes, Your Honor.
The entire argument on those two assignments of error constitutes maybe two paragraphs in your brief. I think it's less than a full page. And you cite one case that really is not on point to anything. How in the world can we decide this case without you giving us some citation to the legal authority upon which our decision should be based?
Your Honor, it was my hope that I would be able to rely greatly on the facts that were presented presented in the case for the court's consideration.
The Supreme Court just very recently came out with a case dealing with waiver of argument. And the court said, if the appellant believed the trial court erred, the rules required her to present that error to us with legal authority to support her contention. Simply put, it is not the role of the courts, trial or appellate, to research or construct the litigant's case or arguments for him. And where a party fails to develop an argument in support of his or her contentions or merely constructs a skeletal argument, the issue is waived. And I guess my question to you is, without legal authority in support, without a legal argument, why shouldn't we deem this argument waived?
Your Honor, I would just argue to the court that the ends of justice would present a case where the court's consideration of the facts, the court's consideration of the statutory requirements in this case would open an opportunity for the court to consider whether or not the determination by the lower court was adequate.
All right, thanks.
That being said, I believe that there are two considerations before the court today, and that would be the best interest of the child. And again, ends of justice, I would say would or submit to the court and ask the court to consider whether or not the best interest of the child would be met. And in an instance where the child will not know the identity or whereabouts of his family and not know the parent from which he's come from, I'd ask the court to consider policy arguments, thereby being the preservation of the family unit, the protection of the familial relationships under the 14th Amendment. I would ask the court to consider whether or not the conduct justifies severance of the relationship, and note that the transcript shows, visitation between the parents and this child ceased on April 21st of 2016, I believe about a year and 4 months before the appeal de novo in the circuit court. I would just like to reiterate that less drastic alternatives were available, that there was no exploration of potential avenues for supporting the parent.
Is that in the record? These other avenues that are available?
No, Your Honor. I believe they were, no avenues were explored because the department made a determination that there were should be no reasonable efforts made to reunite the family.
It was because of the prior
determination
of other children's parental rights to other children. Six others.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's statutory.
It's also a part of the record, Your Honor, where the social worker testified regarding the fact that, based upon the prior terminations, the department determined that there would be no reasonable efforts required.
And so there were none?
There were none made. I would ask the court to consider that the child was removed on December the 28th, and again about 4 months later, visitation between the child and the parent were ceased on February.
Were there logistical issues in terms of the visitation, though?
Yes, Your Honor, there were. The parents relocated in part due to the fact that once the child was removed, then the Department of Social Services
saw. But the ceasing then was not solely on the part of the department. There was a logistical issue that impacted the visitation, correct?
I would argue, Your Honor, that was in part due to some of the department's actions insofar as taking child support or taking out a claim for child support against the parents whose sole source of income was Social Security. And it thereby cut their income in half and not imprisoned a case where they had to relocate in order to maintain housing. I would ask the court to consider that in the four-month time span between the time that the child was removed and the time that visitation was ceased, there was really little time to assess the parental capacity of the parents and little time to provide meaningful services.
Well, the legislature has already made a legislative determination of the parental preparedness for taking care of children without abuse and neglect. It's under the very statute we're talking about, which is they're giving presumptive weight. I don't think it's conclusive necessarily, I would think. Presumptive weight to the termination of parental rights with respect to other children. And on that alone, you can go forward with what has happened in this case. So apparently the legislature thinks that's enough, never mind time, to get it together, if you will, that alone would be enough. So what would you think would have to be provided to the court under such a circumstance where the legislature has said you don't have to make an effort to take reasonable efforts to reunify, and we don't have any other avenues? What should mother have done? What could you have presented? Did you present something that would counteract and rebut the weight of those prior terminations? Or do you think they should not have been considered on the issue of the best interest of this remaining child?
Your Honor, if I may, I didn't understand the last portion of the question, but I can address the first portion. I guess I would submit to the court and ask the court to consider the fact that although the legislature does assign a presumption, if you will.
Sounds like one, I don't call it that, but it's pretty weighty.
Yes, Your Honor, of the prior removals, I would ask the court to consider that the legislature also contemplated that less drastic alternatives may be made available under the at-risk finding, even if an at-risk finding is determined based upon those prior removals. The legislature provides an opportunity that there is something other than the transfer of custody of this child.
Doesn't the parent bear some of the responsibility for identifying those less drastic alternatives?
I would argue, Your Honor.
No?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
They do have some responsibility.
Yes, Your Honor.
Other relatives, other whatever they can identify. So, and none were, no alternatives were advanced by mother, were there?
No, Your Honor, not that I'm aware of.
Counsel, you're into your rebuttal time. If you'd like to continue, you may.
No, I will cease. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Ms. Beard.
Thank you. May it please the court. Let me begin by thanking this panel for moving this hearing from yesterday to today. I think all three out of four of us were all in Fauquier Juvenile Court yesterday morning, so it was appreciated by the juvenile court. Second, I want to take a moment to apologize for my mismanagement that resulted in you having no appellee's brief in the prior matter. That was an oversight on my part, and I apologize because I think a brief would have assisted this panel in reaching a determination.
Can you help me? Maybe, I don't know if you heard my comments in the previous hearing, but I'm still trying to determine which is the final order, or the at least the appealable order that was entered in the circuit court. And I'm looking at the three orders that were entered on September 19, 2007.
Yes, Your Honor.
2017. Which of those and is appealable, or all appealable? I don't know.
This is my reading. There's some case law that the panel is probably familiar with it. The adjudicatory order itself alone is not appealable. There can be no appeal to this court until the dispositional order is entered. Now, because this was a circuit court appeal, both the adjudicatory order and the dispositional order were entered on the same date, which ordinarily doesn't happen. It is my reading of the law that both the adjudication and the dispositional order are appealed at the time of the appeal of the dispositional order.
Because the adjudicatory order is now basically subsumed up into the final.
The adjudicatory order is now part of the dispositional order, and there was no. Now, I do want to point out that as I read the statutory scheme, and you're the Court of Appeals, but there's no statutory mechanism to appeal the emergency or the preliminary removal, the imminent threat threshold.
278.2 is the
order appealable
that's order, appealable.
And it has a different standard. It says the court has to find. Let me find this.
Well, my question is the dispositional order in this case the functional equivalent of an order entered under 278.2?
It is an order entered under 278.2.
And if we reverse that order, where do we end up? What are we doing if we reverse that order?
I guess it depends on the. And this just happened to me last month, so it depends on why you reverse it. If you reverse it because the court made the wrong findings, you're saying it depends on what you reverse. Did you reverse the at-risk finding?
What if the court makes no findings? Because I'm familiar with a case where essentially that was the particular issue of the circuit court not making a finding under the correct portion.
Is that my Sternberg case from last
yes.
month? Yes, okay.
I was trying to call on a case.
I know the case.
I believe
what the panel did was to send it back to the circuit court judge and say, you need to reconsider this and make a finding based on what you're finding. That was my understanding. The counsel on the other side read it differently, and we're still waiting to see what our circuit court judge does with that. So I can't
update
you on that.
And I can't clarify that for you right now.
No. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. The appealable order is the dispositional order in which the adjudicatory finding is subsumed. It depends on where you find there's error. Of course, we don't believe there's error. There were two sealed orders from courts.
I want to follow up with this question, and I am not a big fan of check-the-box orders because I find them as confusing as they could possibly be.
They are confusing. I will say this in their defense. They're designed to help us comply with federal regulatory requirements for funding.
But the order that was appealed from the J&B court is a dispositional order for underlying petition of foster care plan.
Correct.
Which is clearly an order entered pursuant to 278.2.
Correct.
And that form is not the same form that was used by the circuit court.
The form's changed.
But the form that's used by the J&D court has has a number of findings checked that do not appear in the circuit court order. And I'm specifically talking about findings made by the juvenile court that continued placement in a home would be contrary to the welfare of the child. Reasonable efforts have been made to prevent removal of the child. Those two particular findings. Is the circuit court order deficient because it doesn't make the findings that appear to be required by 278.2? This is, if you look at page 51 of the appendix.
I'm looking. Yes.
I think it's 51 of the appendix. If I have the right.
But you're specifically referring to page 52 in the appendix with the juvenile court order.
I've got 51. Let me. I've got two appendixes numbered differently, so it's. Yes.
Right.
Yes. Page 52.
Yes, in my review, there should be, the court is correct, there's a page missing from the order entered by the circuit court. There is a page missing. Those findings, I'm seeing that for the first time this second.
What does that do for our ability to review the order is, I think, part of the point that the court's making. If we don't have the whole order and we can only consider the record and the court speaks through its orders, where does that leave us?
Is it the circuit court?
Yes.
The page out of the circuit court case?
Yes.
Is it from the JDNR?
Yes.
This is the order, and I'm looking at page 644 of the appendix. And again,
Are you on Michael's appendix or
that's
Sarah's?
That's the problem.
I'm on Sarah's appendix.
I'm on your appendix.
This is the circuit court disposition order begins on page 708 of the Sarah Civis.
Correct.
And you'll see
that's the order that's missing a page in the appendix.
Yes, there should be between 709 and 710. There should be a page A of Form 553. The court needs to make those findings, although.
So we need to look in the record and see if it's. If it's actually in the record and the court did make those findings.
I think that would have to be done. I agree, yes.
The findings are not made in any other document?
I'm looking.
Well, are we so just wedded to form litigation that doesn't matter?
Form.
Not in any other document.
There is a finding in, let's see.
Later.
Well, isn't there one in Michael's, though, under 649? And I may be incorrect. So.
I don't have Michael. I only brought one.
I'm looking at 649, where it actually goes through the abuse and neglect and at risk.
I prepared that page for the court.
Where it appears that there have been the findings that are necessary, but they're not in
Sarah's. And I don't know if that page got lost in
well,
the
well,
shuffle.
Well, it's in the record. If it's not in the appendix, it's not a deal breaker.
If it's not in the record, we have a problem.
Okay. You know, you convinced me I'm not crazy. That's an achievement, believe me.
So that is, and you're telling me it is present in Michael's order. So I did. I didn't dream preparing it.
Well, let me just make sure, because as Judge Putty's indicated, the appendix get a little confusing.
Okay, we're looking at Michael's now.
This is Michael's appendix. Is where I see it. At 648 is where that page is that he's talking about. But I think it starts on 646 is where the order starts.
It's the foster care plan.
Yeah. And if you go to 648, I think it's the part.
In fact, it comes earlier than that, 644 and up.
That's the disposition order.
That's 648.
No, go ahead.
abuse and neglect occurred. Is that true? Court further finds.
Yes. So it's just stuck in.
It's in Michael's, but.
But it's not. It's not a part. Oh, 553. Yeah, it is. Okay. All right. That's.
Is it there?
Yeah.
So the court did make those findings regarding the child.
But let me ask a different kind of question. Let's assume that the page that we're looking for cannot be found, but no one has raised it on appeal. Nobody has raised that failure, that error, if it is error, on appeal.
That's true.
Well, I don't see how we can deal with it then. It's not before us. If it's an error, it's got to be overlooked.
It's got to. That's true. It has to be.
I mean, you know, it'd be nice to be perfect up here, but we only do what we're told.
It would be nice to be perfect down here, and clearly I've failed that test in at least one of these cases today.
In other words, we could create the whole case if you give us half the chance, but that's not the way we work.
No.
So if one of the attorneys has not raised it, I don't think it's before us. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. Maybe that's not the answer, but if there's another answer, I'm sure you'll give it to us.
I'll take that answer.
Mr. Mayor, do you want to get to the 5A12 argument that Judge Petty's raised in reference to not having any
that's
authority?
That's in Mother's case.
Yeah. In Mother's case that she's failed to provide authority?
Yes. Because technically that's where we are. We're in Mother's case, even though we're going back and forth in the records.
Yes. Let me say this, and I think counsel has done what she can with the case she has. I'm not sure what she could have given you that would have changed it. From at least from my point of view, in analyzing this case, both cases, there's nothing she really could have given.
So this is an issue of first impression. There's no case law whatsoever that we could rely on in deciding the issue.
Well, I think all the case law that you could rely on says this was within the court's discretion. It's a preponderance evidence standard. There was evidence presented at the trial,
but
there's no abuse of discretion.
I think the point of the Supreme Court's opinion, and it cites several of our opinions, is that when we do an opinion to guide the circuit court, the trial court, and particularly in instances where we are reversing the trial court, it's our obligation to provide to that trial court judge the case law that supports our conclusion. Because we don't make things out of whole cloth. And unless the litigants give us the cases that support their argument, we're really at a disadvantage in advising the trial court what they did right or wrong. And that's always a problem because that puts us in a posture where we are becoming an advocate for a party. We are doing the legal research for a party. We are deciding which cases are appropriate and which portions of those cases to include in opinion. And that's simply not the function of any appellate court.
That is correct. I have raised that issue in prior appellee's briefs in this court.
That's me.
I have raised it in other cases. I did not raise it in this case. I think that I've tried to explain to the panel why I didn't raise it.
Well, perhaps we can be somewhat more lenient in issues that are sufficiency issues only, that don't involve significant legal questions, and we have been a little more more lenient in those. But questions of legal questions such as the introduction of evidence or the authentication of a court order, you know, really does require us to cite opinion, cite case law.
Correct.
Anyway, I'm sorry I took it.
No, that's. This is like a criminal case where the parent's attorney needs to appeal because the client told them to appeal, but there's no Anders brief for TPR, and that makes it extremely difficult.
Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel. You've got, I think, a little bit of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, if I may go back to address the issue, I guess I'm asking the court today to take into account that I've made attempts to try to find legal precedents, to try to find cases on point that are similar to this issue. This case is unique in that it's addressing the issue of prior terminations and what it means for a parent who moves forward, has another child under their 14th Amendment right, and what it means for their ability to parent that child. I'd ask the court to consider, notwithstanding that there may be harmful error if there is a precedent established where it is allowed for forum shopping for better parenting situations, which I believe this case is presenting the unique issue of. I'd ask the court to consider...
If we adopt your argument and looking at your prayer for relief, if we reverse the trial court's finding that the child is at risk for abuse and neglect, does that mean the trial court has no option other than to return the child to parent?
No, Your Honor. At that point, the child could probably remain in foster care, and the department would pick up, as it would in any other foster care case, where they would have temporary custody of the child, create...
Well, if the child's not at risk of abuse and neglect, and there's no finding that the child was actually abused and neglected, how can DSS... have custody, acquire custody of the child?
If the court were to decide not to overturn the finding of at risk and to allow that to not reverse that decision by the circuit court, that would allow for the court to now order the department to present new foster care plans or permanency plans, which would lay out a plan for preventative services for the parents and allow the department to retain custody of the child.
Basically change the goal to return to parent as opposed to adoption.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, I think the status of the child has a life of its own in a sense. So even though the court may have been wrong at circuit level, the child is not automatically returned to parent. I think you have to go through the process that DSS has set up for making sure that circumstances are appropriate for the return to the parent.
Yes, Your Honor.
Interesting question. It's come up before. I'm not sure I really know how it really works in the end.
Your Honor, and I apologize. Are you looking for a response?
No.
Okay.
Sometimes
I'm sorry.
Pontificate.
I sometimes make statements that I expect, and not necessarily expect a response, but they often provoke a response, which is what I'm looking for. But if there's no response, it's okay. You're not an obligation to respond.
Thank you.
Question.
Unfortunately, counsel, your time is up.
Thank
we're going to come down and
thank you.